Hello, I'm Lachlan Peters. This is In the Shadows of Utopia. As we are moving into the third season of the podcast, a season that will cover the rise and fall of the Khmer Rouge regime from 1970 to 1980, we will see the Khmer Rouge wage a war, conquer Cambodia, establish their government, begin their revolution, and in doing so, plunge the country into a darkness that takes the lives of more than 2 million people, as they enslave the population in a countrywide prison with no walls. By the end of the decade, they will no longer be in power, not off of the map completely, however, and that will be another season of the show. But if you're here now, listening to this, perhaps as a new listener, looking to just get started at the 1970 mark and season three, maybe you just want a shortened version of what happened in the 10 to 15 years that came before this, the period of Cambodia's independence after the French War in Indochina, this would be a good place to sort of start. Or maybe you've been listening through, but you're like me and perhaps quite partial to, you know, a previously on at the start of a new season of a TV show. But if you're a new listener or an old one, either way, let's recap the second season of the show where we traced the path of Cambodia in a sort of golden era, a period of peace and prosperity, perhaps masking some pretty serious issues. And, you know, it was called this Island of Peace until, as we saw, it very much wasn't by the end of the decade. The principal character in this era was, of course, Norodom Sihanouk, who began the season in 1956 with about as much control over a country that a person can have, but ended it in 1970 in Beijing, in a coalition with the Chinese, Vietnamese and Khmer Rouge, having been ousted by his own government. We also spent plenty of time following the path of Salot Sar, as he had finished his studies in Paris, came back to Cambodia during the war to join the Khmer Communists fighting the French with the Vietnamese, and then afterwards began living a double life, as a teacher by day and a revolutionary by night, eventually becoming leader of the Cambodian Communists and going back to the jungles in the 1960s, where he slowly developed the party and an armed rebellion against the Cambodian government. By 1968, had launched the war he had been trying for so long to get going. So let's revisit everything in and around and in between all of that history, which also included a few CIA plots, numerous bogus elections, four American presidents, Agent Orange, the Vietnam War, the Cultural Revolution in China, several assassinations, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the Sam Lout Rebellion, and the secret bombing of Cambodia. Before we do that, a reminder that you can support the show for as little as $2 a month on Patreon. That money helps me pay the rent, feed my cats, and to support the time it takes to research, write, and record the show. A portion of your donation also goes toward two separate and amazing charities in Cambodia, helping the young and old in a country still trying to get on its feet, as well as sick dogs and cats that are suffering on the streets of Phnom Penh. So any help there is greatly appreciated, and you can also help out by simply leaving a review or a rating on the platform you are listening to this on. I read them all, and of course, thank you so much to the people who have signed up and donated in the past. With that out of the way, let's get started. We kicked off this season in the wake of an election. Sihanouk had stunned everyone by abdicating the throne and contesting the elections as Citizen Sihanouk, creating a new party to steal the best talent from all the other popular parties. He called it the Sangkum Riastranistrum, which vaguely translates to our socialist community. It was a name that was supposed to capture a bit of left-wingness from the Popular Democrat Party and the Communists, but as we saw, was a real hodgepodge of ideas and filled with people from across the political spectrum. But his victory in that election meant that the Democrats, the kind of nationalist party which carried on the legacy of Son Yat-sen and filled with, I think it's fair to say, the younger generation, quite serious people, well, they were marginalised and subjected to intimidation by Sihanouk's cronies, such as Lon Nol. After a couple of attempts at the elections, realising that it was pretty much rigged against them, eventually the Democrats just gave up and dissolved the party, particularly in the face of, you know, physical threats. This was the most noticeable example of the long process of denying legitimate political means of making change in Cambodia. It was basically a result of Sihanouk wanting to keep power, putting political opponents against each other so he would remain on top, and done so because he personally really didn't trust that these parties could keep Cambodia in a better position than he could. One of the many effects of this was that it pushed some more moderate people to more activist positions. A relatively moderate left-wing person might see no other option but to throw their hat in with the communists, and then eventually join them out in the countryside. And what were the communists doing in this early period? Well, you'll recall that they had a two-faced approach to this back in the mid-1950s. They had the official Communist Party, as in the political party that would contest elections and have representatives out in the open, but they also had the clandestine party in the shadows. That was the Kampuchean People's Revolutionary Party. The party had only existed for a few years independently, created once the Indochinese Communist Party had been split down national lines by the Vietnamese, and that party name was the one that they got in that process. For the Cambodians, you'll recall that they were also left with basically a skeleton crew of party members after the Geneva Accords, which had sort of settled the peace at the end of the war, with the majority of the so-called Khmer Viet Minh, the Cambodian communists, who had been in the war against the French. They had basically gone back to Hanoi to do training there, including the leader, Son Nhoc Minh. Now, these Khmer communists who stayed in Vietnam won't really come back until, well, for us, it'll be in season 3 of the podcast, but essentially, they will have stayed there so long as to become tainted in the eyes of those running the Cambodian Communist Party while they've been gone, so keep an eye on that one. But back in the mid-50s, in Cambodia, the party was head up by Thu Samut, a former monk who had been in the jungles on the border with Vietnam, when a young revolutionary who had just returned from Paris joined the cause. That was, of course, Salot Sar. Cho Samut became a mentor for Sar, kind of took him under his wing, and Sar had excelled in the role, kind of as a jack-of-all-trades and good communicator. He had the Paris-educated thing going for him, even though he'd only, you know, done a year of radio electricity. He also had the French Communist Party thing going on, but he wasn't overly intellectual either, and he could mix well with those from, let's say, more meagre backgrounds. Sar had come back from the Marquis, the jungle, pretending to most of the people that he knew from his former life, you know, the acquaintances that were not communists. Well, he lied to create a cover story, said that he had never found the Khmer Viet Minh, and sort of went from there. Aside from helping out with some grassroots political stuff with another mentor figure he had met in Paris, who didn't know the extent of his commitment to the communists, Sar kind of kept up appearances by becoming a teacher in Phnom Penh. His students loved him, nothing but good things to say about him, had a very sort of generous and calm style, he could sort of recite poetry just off the top of his head, he was a quite comforting teacher. But he and other secret communists, intellectuals like Yang Sari and Son Sen, who had also been in Paris, they began setting up across different high schools in the capital, and also slowly recruiting those students who they felt would make good communists. And the experiences that some of these students that were all in Paris together sort of translated to this Cambodian environment as well. Like, just how they had their secret study sessions in Paris, discussions of civics, nationalism, imperialism, all of that would provide a springboard for more subversive, radical discussions if you were kind of chosen to be invited to the real study session. It was around this time that the Cambodian communists began referring to their organization as ANCA, the organization. By 1957, the movement was no longer in decline, and was just beginning to start growing its numbers again. And just when it was seeming like they had a number of networks set up in the city and the countryside, one of the highest-ranking members, Siu Heng, defects to Sihanouk. This was a massive setback, particularly for the rural networks, which stagnated for a while after this, because Siu Heng had been in charge of them, and the urban party, particularly in Phnom Penh, where Saar was, this kind of by de facto became the backbone of what was becoming the new Cambodian Communist Party. It kind of matured without much of the influence of the old guard who had stayed in Vietnam, or for that matter, the influence of some of the Issarak guys who were party members, but still out in the countryside and sort of dislocated from what was going on in the city. Due to these kinds of circumstantial things, however, it's paving the way for the relative newcomer, Salat Saar, to be rising in the ranks due to his closeness to somewhat, and his involvement in the Phnom Penh branch, and his, you know, brief but still important experience at the end of the French Indochina War, which he had and some of the more intellectual guys, say, like Yang Sari or Son Sen, didn't quite have that. So Saar was able to capitalize that, and as we say, he's rising through the ranks. It was around this time that Pol also got married to a woman named Q Ponnery, a highly intelligent person whose sister, Q Thirit, had also married within the party to Yang Sari. So Yang Sari then becomes Salat Saar's brother-in-law, and it's, you know, one big revolutionary family. It was in 1960 that a very important moment came for the Cambodian communists. Near the Phnom Penh railway station at night, 21 of the leading members got together in cramped, sweaty conditions to discuss the crisis of identity that their party was in and what the future looked like for their movement. They set out to define their party, one based on Marxism-Leninism, a party of the working class, organized on democratic centralism, self-criticism. They would try and nationalize the means of production and achieve a people's democratic dictatorship, then go on and create a socialist system. Very classic communist stuff. They elected their own leadership without the input of Hanoi for the first time, which was kind of a big deal. This took steps toward an independent party line, as they would put it, and planned for the eventual need to take up arms if political means towards their goals failed. In hindsight, we can say that this 1960 Congress was a big step towards the coming disaster. But at the time, particularly from the point of view of the Cambodian communists, it seemed like a rational step to try and organize a little more self-governance. This was the date that they will eventually give as their first party congress, which meant that they saw this as the birth of their party, as opposed to the early 1950s, when the Vietnamese had split the Indochinese party. It was the first sign that they would go in their own direction. But for the next decade and a little bit longer, their comrades in Vietnam still had most of the control. Meanwhile, Sihanouk is aggressively pursuing a total grip on power via parliamentary means and his own gravitas and influence as the former king. Basically, he, one by one, begins to pick off the other genuine political parties until there is only one in town, the Sangkum. But it's not all smooth sailing for him. In 1959, he becomes aware of a plot to overthrow him coming from within and outside Cambodia, the so-called Dap Chuan plot, named after the prominent warlord from the war with the French who had gained quite a bit of power in the northwest of the country. Well, he'd been contacted by some CIA agents who felt that it would be better if they could get rid of Sihanouk and his silly neutrality policy and install someone a bit more friendly to US interests, particularly when it came to propping up South Vietnam. The plot was discovered, however, and Sihanouk sent Lon Nol out to basically kill Dap Chuan. As you can imagine, Sihanouk had fairly low patience for a coup attempt against him, and it further spoilt the relations between himself and the USA. But he was still happy to get as much financial and military aid off of them as possible, and from China and France and anyone else that would chip in. We must have used the phrase having your cake and eating it too about 5 times in these episodes, because this was the beginning of the balancing tightrope walk for the prince as he attempted to navigate the tricky proposition of neutrality while also asking for support from both sides. This relationship with the US deteriorated even further when, in a slightly more lazy attempt at assassination, some elements of the Diem regime in South Vietnam plop a bomb into a gift box and send it to the royal palace in Phnom Penh. The explosion only killed the poor bloke tasked with opening the royal mail, but Sihanouk, the Queen Mother, and the King were in an adjoining room and obviously shaken by the attempt. If the Americans had wanted an ally in Cambodia to help stem the tide of communism coming down from China, well, they had gone about it in a pretty ham-fisted way. Sihanouk himself is pretty erudite in his reading of the situation at the time, writing in a diary about how communism was contrary to human flourishing and rights and freedoms, but in the effort to contain it, the West was propping up states that were employing starkly non-liberal methods of rule as long as they were seen to be stopping the spread of communism. And this was clearly evident in neighbouring South Vietnam. And let's talk about Vietnam for a bit because, well, it did form around 8 hours or so of Season 2's story. Vietnam's been the real driver of independence in the region. And in particular, it was the Indo-Chinese Communist Party, and then, as I said, they became the Vietnam Workers' Party, which had the most significant influence over that independence movement and over the Laotian and Cambodian subordinates to them. They'd been the most organized force capable of taking on the French. And now that the French were gone, the VWP had managed to secure North Vietnam as their own via the Geneva Accords. In the three-part episode I did on the origins of the Second Indochina War, we talked about how the Vietnamese communists in the north consolidated their power and looked to develop a socialist state fully, spreading what they had already done in the jungles and villages and mountains during the struggle with the French onto the whole country above the 17th parallel, the line that divided North and South Vietnam. And we spoke about one infamous aspect of this attempt to, you know, create a new socialist society, the so-called land reform campaign that lasted from 1953 to 1957. This campaign sought to redistribute land, collectivize farming, and equalize the society. And many executions took place as a matter of state policy to facilitate this process. Probably around 10 to 15,000 people. This was accompanied by show trials and public humiliations, as similar to, say, the People's Republic of China under Mao and in the Soviet Union. Although both Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap did admit that excesses and mistakes were made during this land reform campaign. We also talked about other examples of how the North was a repressive place to live. There were thought crimes, educated people with the wrong ideological stance could be sent to labor camps and things of that nature. Standard stuff in comparison with, as we said, China and the Soviet Union during their attempts to create a socialist state, and apparently everything that necessarily comes along with that, as we see in the historical record. South Vietnam was also going through this period of change, itself a kind of new country under the new presidency of Ngo Dinh Diem. He felt that ruling the country could be done on the back of having an army and an administrative apparatus. Power was concentrated into the hands of a relative few, and in the Ngo family in particular, who had control pretty much over the military and foreign policy, while the constitution afforded the president a bunch of emergency powers. Now, we also saw how Diem was less of a puppet of the Americans than many people tend to assume. And there really was a kind of, they needed each other kind of arrangement. It was a marriage of necessity rather than choice, really. And just a year into the project, the CIA was already worrying about the huge gap between the government and the people, and they were secretly worried that they had basically created a kind of dictator. Diem quickly backs out of the arrangement that would have seen a vote of all of the people in Vietnam about unification, which was predicted to go to the way of the North. And Diem basically says, well, it wasn't me, it wasn't my government at the negotiation table, so I don't think I really have to do that. Xi'an begins a series of anti-communist campaigns in the country, wiping out scores of party members that had stayed behind, basically killing or imprisoning anyone associated with this kind of revolutionary activity. It was a brutal way of doing things, but it did affect the communist numbers in the South significantly. Where there was something like 50,000 in 1954, there was only around 5,000 in 1959. This led those remaining in the South, particularly under the guidance of Lê Duẩn, who will go on to become the leader of the Vietnamese communists. So he lobbies the Northerners to allow them to wage an armed struggle in the South. This led to the creation of the National Liberation Front, the NLF, and this was how the Vietnamese Civil War began. The Eisenhower regime had invested a lot in South Vietnam, being this glowing example of the containment of communism. Xi'an was their guy. They were committed. As the insurgency in the South got worse, it became apparent that the US would need to stick or twist. But instead of making a widespread re-evaluation of the US role in Vietnam, the entanglement truly began, as the role of military personnel, known as advisors, were allowed to begin accompanying South Vietnamese troops on operations. This began the process of passing a very complicated baton from one administration to the next. And once Kennedy got into the White House, various factors were at play domestically and internationally that led to further escalation in Vietnam. Events in Berlin, Laos, Cuba, as well as Khrushchev signaling the intent for the Soviets to support wars of liberation around the world, meant that Kennedy needed a bit of a statement. Vietnam ended up being that. Washington could reasonably argue that the insurgency in South Vietnam was being directed by and supported by the North, which was a violation of the Geneva Agreements, and kind of boiled down to a they-started-it argument. The communists would argue that not having the vote and Xi'an's persecution of communists in the South was the they-started-it point. In any case, Kennedy bolstered the troop presence in South Vietnam and looked at counter-insurgency methods to stop the Viet Cong, including, as we went into a lot of detail about, the use of chemical defoliants, such as Agent Orange. In 1963, the first of our big years in the show for the season, the other being 1968, South Vietnam fell into a crisis. It was called the Buddhist Crisis, actually, and I recommend going back to that episode if you've forgotten some of the details, but we looked at explaining exactly what happened with the infamous self-immolation of Quang Duc. It was not about the Americans in the Vietnam War. It was about what kind of country South Vietnam was going to be, particularly this vision as it differed with the Catholic Xi'an family and the fact that the majority of South Vietnamese were Buddhists. It was a miserable few months, and things looked very bleak for the southern regime. So bad, in fact, that even some in the administration considered contacting the North to see if they could work out a settlement. The Americans were not having that, however. Some South Vietnamese generals were reaching out to US officials saying that they could no longer support Xi'an. And the response was basically, okay, well, if you want to get rid of him, you want to get rid of him. On the 1st of November, that is exactly what they do, and they end up murdering both Xi'an and his brother. Less than 3 weeks after that, Kennedy was killed in Dallas. President Johnson, who takes after Kennedy, will continue escalating the conflict in the South, under the impression that backing down would be detrimental to US prestige, while simultaneously, like all the other presidents that tackled the problem, having serious doubts about the feasibility of success and what that looked like in Vietnam. A revolving door of South Vietnamese generals will take up leadership positions, and the political situation will stagnate and regress. Meanwhile, back in Cambodia, after the train station meeting, the Cambodian communists had sought to continue their political means of gaining power, but with an eye on the potential need for arming themselves and doing like their comrades in South Vietnam. They attempted, however crudely, to paint Sihanouk as an extension of US imperialism and feudalism, and therefore a worthy enemy of socialist class-based revolution. They continued to recruit heavily in high schools and then broadened out into the rural areas to reconnect what had been lost during Siu Heng's defection. all while the public-facing Communist Party ran in elections that were quickly becoming farcical as Cambodia became a one-party state under Sihanouk. Just like the Democrats, it became too dangerous to put candidates up for election, and the so-called out-there Communist Party eventually folded. So the public-facing party became a lost cause, and the underground became the most viable communist, even the most viable anti-government group in the country, as all political opposition was ruthlessly crushed by Sihanouk and his police. One victim of that was the head of the party, Thu Samut. He was killed in 1962, which led to Pol taking the lead of the party along with Nuon Chea as his deputy. This provided the first of a few opportunities for the younger, urban-based party members to take more control of the party. That isn't to be confused with saying it was just the French-educated ones having control, however. You'll sometimes hear that. It was always a mix of the so-called Khmer Viet Minh, the Issarak rural guys, as well as the French-educated people that had been in Paris, like Yang Sari and Son Sen. This is where Pol gets into the ascendancy and begins making close, trusting relationships that in some cases will last until the 90s, whereas some others will not survive his purges once they get into power. The party became increasingly compartmentalized during this time to avoid detection and, you know, one person's arrest not leading to the whole organization being exposed. It was this secrecy that they had learned from the Vietnamese, as well as even from their study of how the early Leninists operated in pre-revolutionary Russia. They were rightly terrified of being captured and killed, and this was made very real for them in March 1963, when a list of 34 subversives was published by Lon Nol's police, and Salot Sar's name was on the list, as well as a few other high-ranking members. This was probably not because they were suspected of literally being the head of the underground communist network, but more likely due to their preaching of the socialist cause, as vague as they would have tried to make it, in the high schools and things like that. Either way, Sar is spooked and doesn't want to end up like his old mentor. So he decides to flee to the jungle in Thay Ninh on the Vietnamese border, and he brings with him Son Sen and Yang Sari. Nuon Chea stays behind to manage things in Phnom Penh. From 1963 to 1968, two major themes emerge when talking about the development of the Khmer Rouge, which we should mention was never a title they used for themselves. That's something that Sihanouk came up with. And he was sort of describing a very French-educated kind of leftist person when he used that phrase. But anyway, aside from commonly self-referring, as we mentioned, to themselves as Angkar, they had also switched the name of the party officially from what the Vietnamese had given them to the Khmer Workers' Party. And then they'll switch this name again in 1966 to the Communist Party of Kampuchea, both steps indicating a direct comparison and even challenge to their comrades in the East, basically saying that, you know, defining themselves as a workers' party, just like the Vietnamese workers' party, was saying we're on equal footing, and calling themselves a communist party was like saying, well, actually, maybe we're a little bit more advanced. And an indication of how they felt about this is that they actually keep this name change to the Communist Party of Kampuchea, the CPK, they keep that secret. And that's pretty much the big first theme. It's the steadily growing antagonism that the leaders of the Cambodian communists will develop towards the Vietnamese. Now, this is due to a few factors. Obviously, the first is the very long-standing tensions between the two peoples going back hundreds of years to when parts of Cambodia were annexed by Vietnam. If I were to describe the dynamic again here, it's that the Vietnamese are slightly ambivalent toward the Cambodians, and the Cambodians are even more aggravated by that because they are anything but ambivalent toward the Vietnamese. It's ambivalence that is probably perceived, rightly or wrongly, as patronizing contempt. So in practical terms, the Vietnamese have basically created the Cambodian Communist Movement, and it was supposed to serve a specific purpose in terms of Vietnamese interests, more than Cambodian ones, back when the main goal was independence from France. I think that's fair to say. Now, in the 60s, once the Cambodians started wanting more autonomy, to the extent that they could operate independently, it didn't change the fact that the Vietnamese were still in charge of any meaningful decisions or directions that they wanted to pursue. And this was now not so much about independence, but about bringing, you know, a new revolutionary society to, well, all of these countries and, you know, defeating imperialism and all of that. Steve Hedder's book, Cambodian Communism and the Vietnamese Model, it's really great on this, and he really makes it clear just how much the Cambodians were following the titular blueprint that the Vietnamese had laid out in terms of basically how to do this. Even though aspects of Cambodian society were not really lined up in the same way that Vietnam was. Now, this will cause some contradictions, but the real tensions will be born out of the Cambodians wanting to go against Sihanouk to protect their movement, to wage an armed struggle and take power, because political attempts had been a dead end. Now, the Vietnamese continually deny them the right to do this, saying that Sihanouk was an important ally for them in the struggle for South Vietnamese independence. And when that was over, then they could talk about what to do in Cambodia. This, as we saw, was a continual source of frustration for at least some of the influential top members of the CPK. It will add a kind of parallel influence onto their ideology and methodology as a party as well. So during this period of limbo, the Cambodian communists continue to grow slowly as Pol Pot waits in the jungle at a place called Office 100. It is during this time that this Khmer Rouge communist ideology develops as well. This whole series has been an effort in explaining all of the different influences on that process, from the French Revolution, Vichy French conservatism and racial thinking, as well as Maoism, Marxism-Leninism, the writings of Stalin. But it was in this period that we began discussing the Cambodian characteristics that were brought into this mix as well. So what does this ideology look like as Pol and Nguyen Chea have meetings about it in the jungle during the mid to late 60s? Well, not only does it take on the character of a fairly typical communist thinking, you know, like class-based categorization of society and the need for highly centralized power and collectivization and all those things, naturally borrowing plenty from Maoism as well by this time, with the role of the peasantry necessarily usurping that of a typical working class in a country where there was a great many more peasants than there was a proletariat. The proletariat being the designation given by socialist theories to the class of industrial workers. And that's the big difference. I think it's where many people get a little bit confused about Khmer Rouge ideology and attempt to make claims that it wasn't really communist because it didn't adhere to some of these orthodox prescriptions of what this is supposed to be. But if you actually listen to what the leaders said about themselves, it's plainly apparent what their ideological aims were and how they imagined the communist revolution working in Cambodia. Khieu Samphan, who had a PhD and wrote his thesis on applying Marxist-Leninist theory to Cambodia, explained it like this, quote, "It is true that the Cambodian Communist Party was based on the poor peasantry rather than the working class. But you can't use that as an argument for saying it wasn't a Marxist party or that there was no economic basis for a communist party in Cambodia. In fact, we applied the criterion of material conditions quite correctly because the poor peasants were the most impoverished, the most oppressed class in Cambodian society, and it was this class that was the foundation of the Cambodian party." End quote. How much the Cambodian communists were trying to make a communist revolution is even more apparent when you go through the primary sources like their meeting plans or their magazine propaganda that they put out during their regime. We'll be discussing a lot more of that in season 3. But back in season 2, in these episodes focused on the ideological development in the jungle, we also spent a bit of time on how this supposed lack of a real proletariat, a lack of an industrial working class, we talked about how this was going to be overcome by the CPK. Essentially, it all had to do with not just the material conditions in Cambodia, but the ways that class could be considered within the Cambodian context. And Buddhist thinking and grammar were knowingly, and probably to a degree unknowingly, employed to consider the idea of being the proletariat, this cornerstone of communist thinking. Well, Pol Pot and others thought of being the proletariat less as an economic condition, as a prerequisite, but rather a mental state that could be achieved. This was given using the phrase Satyarama and conveyed an idea of proletarian consciousness. And yes, class consciousness is a common phrase in socialist thinking, but in this Cambodian context, the idea of consciousness was closely linked to the five aggregates of mind that Buddhists contend make up one's thinking processes, as well as the ideas about mindfulness and things like that. So this could be worked on, this could be forged, this way of thinking, and it would determine one's suitability to engaging in the revolution, and later would largely be used to discern who was not able to attain, you know, this state of mind and was therefore an enemy of the revolution, a counter-revolutionary. We looked at some issues of the Cambodian Communist State newsletter, Revolutionary Flag, for some examples of how they talked about building this state of mind and how important it was for their vision of society in those episodes. Pol Pot had been a Buddhist novice when he was around 10 years old, as well as the earliest leaders of the party, Son Nyokmin and Tu Samut. They were both monks when they joined the Khmer Viet Minh. Ta Mok, another prominent member, he was a monk, as well as many other influential members of the party. It's this sort of cultural milieu that will be shared among most of the people that will form the leadership of the party. And despite all that, when they are in power, they will defrock monks, they will essentially ban religion, they will close pagodas and turn them into pigsties, and they will declare that Buddhism is dead. But it doesn't mean that Buddhist ideas or ways of teaching were completely abandoned. Rather, they were adopted, transformed into this secular communist rhetoric and used to, as Philip Short suggested, transplant these foreign concepts into localized versions that would then propagate in Cambodia. So that's what the central leadership are thinking about while they're waiting to start a war in Cambodia. Pol travels to Vietnam in 1965 to ask for permission to start an armed struggle. He is rebuffed. He then goes to Beijing, just on the cusp of the Cultural Revolution, and finds a much more sympathetic ear to his ideas. This is, as we mentioned, and we've touched on this in Season 1 and Season 2, China has sort of national interests that place Vietnam as something to be sort of looked at with a degree of, you know, suspicion. It's right on the border. And Vietnamese alignment with the Soviets, which is also another massive part of the Chinese border, sort of made them think, if the Vietnamese have control of Cambodia and Laos and they're all aligned with the Soviets, then that could be a bit of a problem. So maybe we want to keep, say, the Cambodians more on our side and be perhaps a little bit more sympathetic to them than what they're hearing from the Vietnamese. Now, all of that has to do with the wider Sino-Soviet split. Again, we started talking about that in Season 1, and we touched again on it in Season 2. But that's happening in the background. That's the, you know, big picture, cold foreign winds as part of the historical hurricane thing. So always keep that in mind with the wider international relations. But in terms of Cambodia, in terms of Pol, so he leaves Beijing, goes back to Cambodia by 1966, and he's more determined than ever to stake out this path to war and seeks to move into a new base in the far northeast of the country in the hills and jungles of Ratanakiri. By this time, the Vietnam War is escalating and it is beginning to impact Cambodian politics as well. The late 1950s and early 1960s are usually remembered with fondness by many Cambodians, generally because it was a period of independence and flourishing, and What came afterwards was hardship, war, famine, death, slavery, and then being dominated by a foreign power until the 1990s. So this period, prior to around 1968, really stands out. And so it should. The arts were funded, there was plenty of foreign aid, plenty of people going to school. Sihanouk could still be thought of as a bit of an eccentric leader, but doing good work to keep Cambodia neutral. But it was not the most open and free society. You'll recall the corruption and the election violence and fraud, and these aspects of society were not just confined to running elections. But without being too critical, let's just say the country was moving along as well as it could. By 1965, Sihanouk had severed diplomatic ties with the United States, basically seeing what had happened to Xi'an as an omen of what can happen if those are your allies, but also foreseeing that it would probably be a communist victory in Vietnam and aligning his future accordingly. He had also been fed up by, as we said, the coup attempts, but also the persistent annoyance of the Cambodian nationalist Son Ngoc Thanh, who, in exile still, had been supported by the Thai and the Americans to maintain a group of militants known as the Khmer Serai. They were always having their little radio announcements that denounced Sihanouk, and he had a bee in his bonnet about Thanh from as long ago as 1945. Potentially as early as the aftermath of Geneva, Sihanouk had been making deals with the Vietnamese communists that would ensure that their influence was kept out of Cambodia, that was their part of the bargain, and in return they could use Cambodian land on the border as a means of supplying the resistance in the south, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Sihanouk was friendly with China as well, perhaps as a potential balance to the Vietnamese, who he, like most Cambodian politicians, including Pol Pot, worried they might one day take over more Cambodian territory. So let's say Sihanouk has a lot on his plate at this time. The issue, as we discussed over the course of a few episodes, is that there was an inherent problem in Sihanouk concentrating so many aspects of governing the country unto himself. It's too much, and he ended up resorting to violence, basically, against anyone who didn't go along in the same way that he wanted them to. At the same time, he was retreating more and more into music and filmmaking as the pressure of keeping the country up and running next door to the Vietnam War, well, that was beginning to cook Cambodia too. One of the biggest ways that the Vietnam War affected Cambodia in the mid to late 1960s is how it changed Sihanouk's focus diplomatically more to the socialist side of the international scene, doing deals with China, North Vietnam, but it's also how this arrangement ends up seeing lots of troops being stationed on Cambodian soil so they can attack and retreat from South Vietnam. But another massive impact was how this affected the Cambodian economy. In a few episodes, we discussed how black market rice sales to the NLF and North Vietnamese was creating a massive void in the Cambodian economy. Basically, a third of their most profitable export was just disappearing. This coincided with Sihanouk's attempts to constantly play what was left of the left in Cambodian politics against the right, favouring one side and then the other in his Sankum government, so he would sort of be manoeuvring his way always on top. In 1966, these political manoeuvres led him to appoint Lon Nol as Prime Minister. He hoped that this would keep the left in check. Lon Nol had always been a long-standing conservative politician, regularly had positions controlling the army, things like that. In 1967, while Sihanouk was away, he basically had the remit to recover what the economy was losing on the black market. In the breadbasket of Cambodia, the northwestern province of Battambang, which, if you'll recall, has been where the first Issarak movement started, this province in particular has kind of gone back and forth as being part of Thai territory over the last, you know, couple hundred years. So the point being that there is a tendency to having a bit of distance in Battambang with the Phnom Penh government, a bit of unease. But anyway, there, Lon Nol begins what was called the Ramassage campaign, basically armed collections of the rice directly from farmers at a fixed price, a price well below what they could have got on the black market. This, as you can imagine, wasn't the most popular thing to do. and local Khmer Rouge in the area are able to stoke up tensions even further. This reaches a climax when some of the troops doing the collecting are attacked and killed by some farmers, who then go on to stage a larger protest and attack more government outposts. This wasn't 100% a Khmer Rouge thing, but they were involved to a degree with the organization and some of the fighting. This will turn into a massive, basically peasant rebellion known as the Samlaut Rebellion, named after the village where it erupted. Sihanouk doesn't hold back. The army, the air force, local militia groups all go after the rebels with extreme prejudice. And the numbers aren't really clear, but there's something like a few thousand, perhaps up to 10,000 people that die. Pol Pot and Nguyen Chea are looking at this peasant outburst thinking, okay, we can't push for a nationwide rebellion just yet. Look how this one has been crushed. But let's take the lessons from this and start planning. Perhaps capitalize on what seemed like a degree of unrest in the rural areas. Now, in the storyline of the show, I also had to make a bit of a detour to explain the Cultural Revolution in China at this point. This bewildering, horrifying set of circumstances that saw the youngest generation there emboldened with a fanatical revolutionary ideology that was bestowed on them by Mao. It was all about him gaining back a bit of the power that had been lost since the failures of the Great Leap Forward. But in the mid-1960s, many parts of China just collapse into a kind of, I don't think it's going too far to say, state-sponsored, self-inflicted civil war. Absolutely wild. Took a long time for me to sort of get my head around it, but the idea really there was constant revolution, and the importance of the youth in being involved in that process, and the idea that you could just literally smash the past and smash ways of thinking. This is the energy that was in the room when Pol Pot was in the country in 1966, and it is officially launched not long after he goes. But this had effects on other countries too, like the Red Guards and the Little Red Book. It was basically being proselytized around the world. So you had Chinese Cambodians taking to the streets and doing, you know, some similar things, and you had embassies being burned in China. It kind of freaked Sihanouk out, and in the aftermath of Samlaut, where he's thinking, well, wait, is there an actual Cambodian communist insurgency here? How much of this is being controlled by Vietnam? He's getting cold feet about the left generally. So he projects that onto the international stage and kind of makes a turn back toward the center and opens things back up to the possibility of US relations again. This was signaled initially when Jackie Kennedy had a holiday in Cambodia in 1967. And then at the beginning of 1968, another big step was taken when he hosted Ambassador Chester Bowles, and they discussed some things, most notably the number of Vietnamese that were on the Cambodian border. By this time, Sihanouk is far less happy with that troop presence, particularly as it had massively inflated as the NLF and North Vietnamese prepared to launch the Tet Offensive at the end of January 1968. So the important thing to come out of this meeting with Chester Bowles was that Sihanouk finally acknowledged that this Vietnamese presence really was there, and he allowed for so-called hot pursuit by American forces to go after them. We know from documents declassified in the early 2000s that there had been the occasional bombing of Cambodian territory, sometimes on accident, and sometimes on accident, in quotation marks. And Sihanouk had always complained about those instances when they'd occurred, you know, from 1965 onwards. But in these meetings, at the start of 1968, they're going to be used as a remit to go much harder on these areas on the border, particularly under the next president. So how do we get to that new president? Well, as I was saying, the Tet Offensive kicks off at the end of January 68. Completely shocks the US military, who think they had the upper hand in a stalemate. And for the Vietnamese communists, it was this audacious attempt to liberate all of the major cities in the south, They thought the people would spontaneously rise up with them, and that there would essentially be a statewide revolution that would dissolve the South Vietnamese government and force the USA to basically pack up their things and go home. As we found out in the episodes on Tet, it was a two-parter, that really didn't happen. It was a massive military failure, but it did provide political and psychological victories. In the US, people watched on their TVs as the embassy in Saigon was attacked. They later saw Walter Cronkite bemoan the lack of progress in the war, and those on the ground in Vietnam saw a Viet Cong flag over the citadel in the old capital of Hue for almost a month. And we spent a lot of time exploring Hue in particular because it was there that the communists had a sustained period of success. They captured most of the city and were even able to initiate the earliest stages of a kind of revolutionary government there. This led to the deaths of thousands of civilians, perhaps around 3,000, who had been marked out sometimes ahead of time for their association with the government. But this also bled out to include people that were just intellectuals as well as their families. Many were apparently buried alive, suggested by the state that they were found in the mass graves that they were killed in. A few weeks after the Battle of Hue was over, and as part of a larger operation to try and pursue the weakened battalions of Viet Cong that had launched the offensive, we followed the story of Charlie Company. They were dropped into a village complex in Quang Nai in mid-March, and were told that they would only be encountering enemy combatants. They ended up slaughtering around 500 people, many of them women and children, so we spent about 2 hours exploring the circumstances that led to that tragedy. Via both of those episodes, I tried to show the horrors of the Vietnam War from both sides, and the nihilism that can be hard to avoid when looking at what happened. President Johnson, by March 1968, on the advice that had now become overwhelming in the direction of either massive troop escalation and bombing, or a withdrawal, decided that he was no longer fit to continue as president and did not seek re-election. This paved the way for Richard Nixon to win the election, campaigning on, amongst other things, a promise to end the war in Vietnam for the Americans. Meanwhile, at the same time that Tet had occurred, the Khmer Rouge had also decided to finally stage a national uprising. They were told not to by the Vietnamese and the Chinese, but they did it anyway. The argument being that they could no longer survive without taking up arms to protect themselves. Both their allies had still valued Sihanouk's position and how that helped them more than what the Khmer Rouge wanted. But the Chinese and Vietnamese were also kind of caught by their own proclamations about what people's war and liberating lands from imperialism meant. Like, they were saying this is what we think oppressed people should do worldwide. Take up whatever arms you can find and get after it. But when it came to the communists in Cambodia, well, their own self-interests and, you know, for Vietnam, it was securing Vietnam first at all costs before opening up a potential new front in that war. So they wanted to keep things as they were. Well, the Khmer Rouge decided to practice the preaching, and with just a few thousand cadre and a handful of arms and ammunition, they started following that People's War blueprint, that Viet Cong blueprint that we covered at the beginning of this recap. Going after isolated outposts, getting more weapons, trying to secure areas through targeted assassinations and things like that. Cambodia in 1968 was in a civil war, and the country will be in some kind of war internally for the next 30 years. But the Khmer Rouge were certainly struggling initially. Lon Nol's army, although itself not particularly well furnished, was still much stronger. By the end of 1969, Pol Pot was wondering what to do, what could change the game for them, and he was summoned to Hanoi to speak with the Vietnamese Workers' Party leadership. By then, Nixon and Kissinger had failed in their mission to get America out of the war in 6 months. They had, however, begun to see Cambodia as a means to an end in a few different ways. They figured that there was a Viet Cong base which was the equivalent of, like, the Pentagon, and it was on the Cambodian side of the border. They called it COSVIN. Nixon and Kissinger had decided to secretly begin carpet bombing these areas to attempt to eradicate it and the other sanctuaries that had been so key to the war effort in the South. The secret bombing of Cambodia began in March 1969 and was eventually given the codename Menu. Sihanouk did not protest to these bombings. While later he will point to these as egregious examples of American foreign policy through bombing, at the time it's harder for us to know exactly how he felt. In those episodes I brought up the possibility that he really didn't care too much about those areas. He felt that it was either filled with Khmer Rouge or Viet Cong, maybe some ethnic minorities that had been opposing him, or some other civilians that weren't aligned with him that had sort of joined the communists. Given that he was happy to do similar things at Sam Lout and how readily he had begun to rely on violent repression of all political opponents in Phnom Penh, as well as, you know, the summary executions of enemies and having it filmed and played in cinemas, one wonders just how much the Operation Menu bombings would have troubled the former king. Particularly because he was under so much pressure to do something about this problem of the Vietnamese troop buildup. This was coming from right-wing politicians, as practically all of the left had given up. Prominent leftist politicians like Khieu Samphan had fled underground and to Khmer Rouge bases once Sihanouk had openly threatened them in the wake of the Sam Lout rebellion. Sihanouk was losing control of things, of his country, and he was making more and more enemies in Phnom Penh. The military were unhappy with his alliances with the communists on the international scene, for historical reasons, if we're talking about the Vietnamese, but also for selfish, greedy reasons, feeling that they would have much more money and, you know, munitions and tanks if they had stayed with the US. Similarly, economic conditions in the country were getting worse and worse, and an educated middle-class person was struggling to find appropriate work in a society where corruption and lack of opportunity were really squeezing them. By the end of 1969, Sihanouk was also contemplating just leaving the country for an extended period to see if his absence would somehow fix these issues. By then, his cousin Sirik Matak, who had been hostile to Sihanouk's policies for years, had risen to a powerful position in the government. And along with Lon Nol, they attempted to settle the Vietnamese problem and the economic issues in their own way. As a means of stirring up opposition to the Vietnamese in the country, as well as to the actions of Sihanouk, a series of riots were orchestrated at the North Vietnamese Embassy and the Embassy of the NLF in Phnom Penh. This led to a kind of frenzy of anti-Vietnamese sentiment that captured the public as well as Cambodian politicians. With Sihanouk out of the country, Sirik Matak in particular began making moves that would lead to a coup against the former king. This culminated on the 18th of March when, with everything lined up, including Lon Nol, who was initially reluctant, the parliament passed a motion to dismiss Sihanouk from power. He finds out about this in Moscow, on the way to Beijing, and there the Chinese make an offer to help Sihanouk get back to power with a coalition of the communist Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge. Sihanouk, fueled by royal rage and vengeance, takes them up on the offer. He makes a declaration to everyone back in Cambodia to not recognize the new imperialist government, to flee to the jungles and join the Khmer Rouge. This was a massive shift in the story. Almost overnight, the Khmer Rouge had gained a crucial ally in legitimizing their cause, the former king who was still hugely popular in rural areas. The new United Front also roped the Chinese and communist Vietnamese into giving tangible military and financial support for their armed struggle, what they'd been asking for years. The Vietnamese would be training Khmer Rouge troops and create an army capable of taking on Lon Nol, although initially they would do much of the fighting themselves. Pol Pot, who was in Beijing when Sihanouk agreed to be the head of this new front, kept himself concealed and instead signed off on the agreement by pretending that the so-called Three Ghosts, the prominent leftist politicians including Khieu Samphan that had fled underground in 1967, had been there and given their approval. Sihanouk, he didn't know who was leading the Khmer Rouge, he didn't know he was in Beijing, and he didn't really even know what the Khmer Rouge were. But he had signed his name on a blank check, and he would live to regret that decision. But in the short term, the impact of him dramatically switching sides like this was huge. His call to arms was heeded by thousands, and the communists and Pol Pot were very quickly in an ascendant position. Communist Vietnamese troops would begin making massive advances west and capturing large amounts of territory, which they handed off to the CPK to administer. In Phnom Penh, the new Republican government went about a process of de-Sihanoukification and sought to deliver on the most pressing issue which they had claimed necessitated the coup in the first place, the Vietnamese problem. Calls by Lon Nol for the Vietnamese troops to simply vacate Cambodia in 72 hours didn't go so well. And quickly, the lines would be blurred about exactly who was a Vietnamese enemy and who was just a civilian. The government, reacting to massive losses to the superior Vietnamese armed forces, quickly dropped any pretense of neutrality and sought massive financial aid and military aid from the Nixon administration. But Lon Nol and Sirik Mattak had kind of misjudged exactly how much help they might receive from Nixon and how long that might last. But overall, as we mentioned in that episode, was what David Chandler had called four huge miscalculations that sort of kicked off the Lon Nol regime. The first was that Sihanouk would meekly step aside once he'd been removed from power. The second was that the Vietnamese would leave Cambodia. The third was that the Vietnam War would stay in Vietnam. And the fourth was that the Cambodian communists would abandon their own struggle for power. And in April 1970, that is where we left off season two. But overall, over that season, there were a couple of big lessons that I wanted you, my dear listener, to take away from what we went through. And one of them was around Sihanouk's role in creating his Cambodia. A balanced take on what is a complicated story would be that the country didn't quite live up to the idea of being an island of peace that it was suggested. That isn't to say Sihanouk didn't do a job at keeping Cambodia, to a large extent, out of the war in Vietnam. But the concessions he made to the communists would eventually cause him problems, and the solutions to those problems were not pretty and highlighted just how entangled beneath the surface Cambodia had been in the Vietnam War. On the Khmer Rouge side of things, I think showing how Salot Sa became Pol and then soon to be Pol Pot was a fairly natural progression. From 1960, it was clear what he wanted to achieve, and his vision was blocked by forces in Cambodian politics and by their allies abroad. But he and the party stuck to it. They copied the Vietnamese as much as possible, and their ideology grew under the influence of the circumstances it was put through, including the need for secrecy and being constantly hunted by Sihanouk's police. I wanted people to understand that the Khmer Rouge were not anarchists or primitivists. They were a standard party following the line that, for instance, the Maoists proclaimed should be followed in a people's war. They were an organized group with a set of principles. They didn't come out of nowhere when American bombs started falling on the country. Lastly, this season continued to highlight what I've been calling for some time, the outside pressures and weather patterns that create the historical hurricane in Cambodia. I hope that people have continued to draw the links between what will happen in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge and what happened, as we've covered before, in the Soviet Union, in the People's Republic of China, and in North Vietnam, going all the way back to when we discussed the French Revolution. There were established codes of conduct for what to do when collectivizing farming or punishing suspect classes or rooting out counter-revolutionaries. But we also spent a lot of time covering the multitude of complications that were caused by the Vietnam War and the American involvement in the region, beginning with commitments in the 1950s that evolved into dropping cancer and deformity-causing chemicals from planes, not to mention the thousands of bombs, culminating in the utter savagery that was on display at My Lai. All in all, I hope that if you were someone that knew enough about this story to be approaching it with some blame in your pocket, ready to be placed on one actor in particular, well, perhaps what you've learnt in the last season will have shown you that perhaps you needed some more blame to be able to share around. I hope you got something out of the season. It's been a pleasure bringing the show to you. It's been almost 7 years doing it, and I love doing it. I've loved hearing from everyone that's gotten in touch as well. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And now there's not that much further to go. So I appreciate you listening so much. If you're part of the, you know, real audience listening even to this recap episode all the way to the end here, and you've listened to the dozens of hours of the rest of the show, thank you. Thank you. If you haven't already, can I please ask that you leave a rating or review, particularly if you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It's a great help to me, and like I said at the start, I read every single one of them. Of course, you can also help out the show in a more tangible way by donating via PayPal or on a regular basis through Patreon. I want to make this last couple of seasons of the show really great and properly pay respect to this tragic history for the people who experienced it and continue to experience its aftermath. You know that the show doesn't cut corners. It takes a long time to properly research, write, rewrite, record, and edit. It's a one-man operation, so if you are able to help me out making it, I would truly appreciate that. And with that, I'll say goodbye. You'll hear from me soon with Season 3 of In the Shadows of Utopia. Until then, goodbye.